Now extended through January 14th, join a clean and spacious Planet Fitness for zero enrollment and only $10 a month. With tons of equipment and free fitness training, it's the perfect place for everybody to work out.
Even me, mister, I'm so stressed I grind my teeth more than most people grind coffee.
Especially you. Give your anxiety clenched jaw a rest.
My molars will be so happy.
Start feeling fit-tacular today. Join in club or at planetfitness.com. Zero enrollment, $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 14th. See club for details.
Okay, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. His name is Stephen Marsh. His last name is spelled M-A-R-C-H-E. He's just published a book, January 4th, 2022. Really a fascinating book. Very timely book. I enjoyed reading it. Title of the book is The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. And Mr. Marsh is a novelist and culture writer who has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The New Yorker, Esquire, and pretty much everywhere else. His books include three novels, The Hunger of the Wolf, Raymond and Hannah, and Shining at the Bottom of the Sea, as well as The Unmade Bed and How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And he's from and lives in Toronto with his wife and children. But really interesting book. Highly recommended. I think that it's kind of quasi nonfiction fiction or something, but there's a lot of references to real events, but speculative future events. But he can talk more about that. So Stephen Marsh, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So thanks for agreeing to the interview. And for people who may not have heard some of your earlier books or your other writings in some of these publications, can you talk about your background and what led you to write The Next Civil War?
Well, I'm a novelist and a journalist. I do both of those things. And this book sort of is both of those hats. I mean, it's speculative nonfiction. That's what I'm calling it. So it's imagined scenarios of future civil war in the United States, but based on research. There's not a word in this that isn't based on research. It's really not a work of imagination so much as I interviewed about 200 people for it, and it's drawn from the best possible models. My model writing it was The Day After, which was the miniseries about a nuclear attack on Lawrence, Kansas, which was actually originally a small piece of fiction written for a congressional report on what fallout from nuclear war would look like. And, you know, it also was fiction, but on the other hand, it was very much based on the science. And so
sorry to interrupt, but that was a huge show. I think it was in the 80s or 70s, but that broke all kinds.
It is to this day the biggest, most watched show in the history of television.
Wow, yeah. Right. So really?
I think it had 180 million viewers at one point. Like, it was bigger than the MASH finale. It changed history too, because Reagan saw it and began the nuclear treaty negotiations immediately afterwards. He records it in his diary. So, you know, that was a wake-up call for people. And the idea for this book is to do the same kind of thing for the crisis facing America.
Great. And so you broke it up into five different parts. You call them dispatches, but your intro, I think, is important because it talks about the immediate future. Can you talk about some of the facts and situations we're in from the U.S. and your perspective being just a little bit above the border?
Well, I mean, the United States is a textbook case of a country headed for civil war. It's when you talk to the experts at PRIO, the Peace Research Institute of Oslo, things that they see in much poorer, much more historically troubled countries than the United States, they're starting to see in the big country, in the United States. And those things are really, really high levels of vertical and horizontal inequality, hyperpartisanship, and the decline of legitimacy of institutions, treating politics as spoils, as well as environmental degradation, which has enormous costs associated with it and leads also to great amounts of anger, as well as, the racial dynamic of a majority ethnic population losing its majority status, which all around the world, everywhere. That's not particular to the pathologies of American racism. That's something that you see everywhere in the world. That tends to lead to violence. So structural problem, I think it's very easy in these angry times to get caught up in the horse race politics. Like, what is Marjorie Taylor Greene's Twitter feed says today? What did Ted Cruz do on Fox News? From the point of view of this research that this is based on, all of that's more or less irrelevant. Like, what is happening is structural, and so the changes that need to be undertaken are structural.
Right. And you reference a lot in that intro the American Civil War. Can you talk about kind of the similar events leading up to that tragedy and why we might be in that same environment now?
Well, I mean, the fascinating thing about reading about the lead up to the first Civil War, which was totally foreign to me as a Canadian, right? I was never taught it in school. So I was really kind of like going to this history, looking for answers about contemporary America, is how little anyone saw it coming. I mean, you know, Fort Sumter happened. Jefferson Davis said, this is probably nothing. This is probably just the end of a little bit of politics. You know, they were so unprepared for it that they had to go to Europe to get guns. Which is, you know, kind of astonishing. And the reason it's astonishing is because in the hindsight of history, you know, the trends had been very consistent for 30, 40 years where, you know, you have people beating senators on the floor of the Senate with canes because they are over slavery. You have people dueling at West Point over slavery. You have every time a new territory opens, you basically have to re-prosecute the entire question of slavery as it enters. You have Bloody Kansas, you have the nullification crisis. And yet with all of that, they still didn't want to see it coming. And I think we're kind of in the same moment now where the deep trends are pointing one way, right? And yet people still really kind of don't want to see it.
Right. It really is fascinating. You had a little section there at the intro, the desire not to see what is coming. So I thought that was pretty fascinating. And also, I mean, you just see a lot of that stuff there. It's unbelievable that they weren't really ready for that event. I mean, can you talk more about kind of the predictions and the sensibility maybe that is happening in the States, like the studies of why this, like what preparations are underway, etc.?
Well, the preparations are underway. You know, there are definitely people preparing for civil war. Like a lot of them, I've gone and met a lot of them, and they're preparing for breakdown, and they're in remote places in Ohio. They're not that remote. They're in small towns in Ohio. They're all over America having prepper conferences, and I attended those, and you know, met with accelerationists and met with people, Nazis, and who are all preparing for the end of the Republic and for a war to follow it. And then, of course, on the other hand, you have the military preparations for a civil conflict, which are quite complicated, in which they really are, the military will be extremely hamstrung. They face a very difficult technical legal situation over if they ever had to encounter, say, an armed militia who decided not to listen to the federal authority anymore, which is the subject of chapter one of the book. The military faces a real problem getting basic things like situational awareness in combat in those situations, which, you know, they saw that in the LA riots of 92 when they called in the troops, and also in Arkansas where they had to call in the troops in the 50s. So there's certainly people preparing for it. But on the other hand, it seems to me like Joe Biden is not preparing for it. You know, that there are a lot of people for whom this is not something that they think is actually a possibility, even though literally tens of millions of their fellow citizens are readying themselves.
Right. No, it is incredible. And there's a lot of talk, especially in the alternate media, definitely not in maybe the corporate media, but there are people put those two words together, civil war, or we're in a low conflict. And it just takes that one match point or one match to really turn that off. And your intro, that first dispatch, is about these conflicts between the perceived patriots who do not trust the federal government and the military response by the federal government. Can you talk about how you played that out in that first dispatch?
Well, I mean, I talked to a series of very senior military people who agreed to talk to me. And I, of course, talked to sheriffs as well, like interpositional sheriffs, which are the kind of, I would say, the spearhead of this movement, at least in government, because they occupy a kind of strange place between, you know, they're not legislated, but they are elected, and they have a kind of unique role in American politics, where many of them think they're in resistance to federal authority. That's their role. So, you know, I talked to both sides of this to get a sense of what the combat would be like. I mean, from a tactical point of view, from a combat point of view, there's unfortunately not much of a story. I mean, I kept going to these soldiers and saying like, well, what would, you know, can you give me some battle? And they were like, you know, we're talking about the U.S. Marines here against a like, it's going to be one-sided completely. Like, you know, one guy said, we'll just turn off the water and that'll be it. Like, you know, like it's there's it would be completely one-sided from a tactical military point of view, even though there are plenty of ex-Marines and there are plenty of highly trained soldiers in the militias. They just don't have the situational awareness or the technological asymmetry is extreme, even though the militias are highly armed and, you know, have access to drones and access to even low grade nuclear weapons. You know, the U.S. Marines are the U.S. Marines. Like, they're not, I would not bet against them against anybody. Never mind, you know, some people in the woods in some rural county. So, so from a military point of view, it's clearly one-sided. But, you know, as America learned in Afghanistan and Iraq and Vietnam, you can't really win a counterinsurgency. Like, you can, the only strategy is not to play. Every time you win a battle, you lose more support from the community. And of course, in America, that would be even more extreme because, you know, the illegitimacy of any occupation would be total. You know, the local people would simply not tolerate it. And so it would likely spiral out of control, you know.
Right. You also mentioned that the difficulty of putting troops against citizenry or whatever kind of group, anti-authoritarian group, is a legal issue. There's huge legal issues involved with that and consequences of that as well.
Total nightmare. I mean, even in the first Civil War, Lincoln was barely able to get to suspend the right of habeas corpus. I mean, and that was only through his particular procedural genius that he knew how to, like, he was a great manipulator of these things. And it was only through that he was able to do it. Yeah, I mean, the problem is waging war against your own citizens who are entitled to rights, right? And who are entitled to procedure and legal procedure. And that creates necessarily a two-tier system. And that hampers intelligence gathering. You know, do you get, how do you, and you know, you, and when you hamper intelligence gathering, how do you hamper, like, how do you do psychological operations? Can you shut down the internet? Like, these are legal questions that actually are totally unresolved and are not really clear at all. And so it would be a total bureaucratic nightmare. I mean, Iraq was a bureaucratic nightmare too, but in the case of what they call a full spectrum operation in the homeland, it would be a true, it would be, you know, so complicated that it would be fought out in court forever and no one would ever be satisfied with the answer, if you know what
right.
I mean.
Right. I mean, it just doesn't seem plausible to be manageable. But it is interesting because you, in that section, you do mention these kind of sheriffs that are about in the American kind of zeitgeist: Arpaio, Mack, Clark, people we see on the news all the often. And you just see that sensibility of the tension between states' rights or local rights and the federal government. Is there really there? There really is that hard. And you mentioned, like, Finicum, that whole, so this, it's there.
Well, they're slightly different. They're sagebrush rebels, so they're more of a separate. I mean, the problem with dealing with the far right in America, far right is really a wrong term. I prefer the term hard right, is that they break and reform all the time, and they take on new shapes all the time, and they're a bunch of tiny little groups that share some sensibilities, but often they go one way and then they go another way. And sometimes it's about tax evasion or tax avoidance and not paying your taxes. Other times it's about, you know, freedom from government surveillance. Other times it's, you know, it really, sometimes it just gets right into QAnon and you go straight into wild conspiracy theories, right? So it's very hard to put your finger on exactly what they are. But the constitutional sheriffs are, like, they're a body. They have conferences.
Right. You said there were 500 guys in one.
I mean, there's also, you know, with these sheriffs, there's also a real strange kind of love of spectacle. Like, they really want to participate in media operations. Like they want to, they're constantly promoting themselves. Like, and they're doing like Arpeo puts prisoners in pink underwear and makes them wear pink. And then he goes on book tours and has pink handcuffs with it. So it's, you know, where the line between your super serious emissary of constitutional order and you're just, you know, making jokes about it. It's kind of a hard line to see.
Right. But it does play into this whole, you know, just what happened yesterday, January 6th event, which is really kind of like a, could be perceived partially as a right-wing populist revolt. I mean, and the consequences of it. So, I mean, I think that you're really there. We're close to something.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, when that event happened, I was not really surprised at all. I mean, it isn't really my thought, but somebody on Twitter the other day said that January 6th was, it was like the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. It was a serious attempt and it was coming, but it's not the big one. Right. It's not the one with the organization. It's not the one with the planning. Right. People want to call it an insurrection. I don't think it meets the definition of that. I mean, you know, I have been in the weeds with this book of the technical definitions of like, what's an insurrection, what's civil strife, what's civil war, what's, you know, what's a riot, what's a rebellion. I don't think it really meets the standard of political coherence required to be an insurrection. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, the other thing that was really, you know, more troubling about January 6th than the event itself, at least for me, was the fact that the politicians there were politicians encouraging it. So that alone is really troubling, where you have Josh Hawley raising his fist to encourage people who then attack him, and which he has to be protected from the people he's encouraging. That seems to me like madness, you know, like the death drive. Like there's something suicidal about that impulse. And then also the fact that they're not able to use legal method against those, like they would not investigate a cause of the riot in their own institution. I mean, that just shows, how do you expect your institutions to survive if you won't protect it? Yeah, you know, the scene yesterday where only Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney came to respect to give a moment of silence to the guard who was killed. I mean, that was chilling to me, because that really shows, you know, violence happens a lot of places. Like, you know, Canada, I know, seems very nice and calm, but like we imposed martial law in 1970. The country has almost ended twice in my lifetime. You know, these things happen to countries. It's really a question of how you respond to them when they do, and how they shape discourse afterwards, if you know what I mean.
I do. I mean, it is incredible how this, you're right, it's a lot of the terminology has been politicized, but whether it's an insurrection or what, it wasn't violent enough, but there was that element of force. So there, something definitely happened. And it's just like one of those escalations, I think, or accelerations, like you mentioned accelerationism in your book too. It's like,
yeah,
these things are moving forward. Then you'd kind of talk about, I think, is another very important point, is this kind of lone wolf kind of activated individuals and the frustrations of people. You talk about demographic change as a predicate to kind of civil war. Can you kind of talk about your inquiries into that and your research into those themes?
Well, I mean, one of the big factors for civil war, I mean, there are several of them, environmental. I mean, the two big ones are when democratic institutions lose their sense of legitimacy and when people stop believing in them. So that's happening in a very dramatic way in the United States and accelerating. And we can talk about that maybe later. But the other one is that as you have dominant ethnic groups in whatever country, and as it's not that they lose power, it's not that they lose anything, it's that groups below them rise towards them and it start to achieve equality. That's what causes violence. That's a major driver of violence. You know, and that's not specific to American race. Like that happens everywhere. Like that happened in India, and it happens all over Africa. It happens all over the Middle East. So if you're at, like, there are many, many components to this horrible machine, but that to me is sort of the main source of terrible energy. And, you know, it's fascinating. The big study that came out of about who was at the January 6th riot, it was exactly that. That was the main driver. Only about 15% were from militias. It was people who are not poor. It was just they were from places where they'd recently seen growth in African American and Latino populations and prosperity. And so it was a reaction against that.
So it's like a dislocation, so they feel threatened. And I think that insurrection, you call the insurrection or whatever, they look 100%, almost 100% white. Like I barely even saw, yeah. I mean, I don't even think it was 99%. I mean, I don't remember seeing one Latino or one African-American there. So I think that's very telling. No. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. But
maybe I'm right, wrong. So, I don't remember one either. I mean, I would certainly say that the far right people that I meet, I mean, there are exceptions, but there's one, like they're almost all white. For sure they are.
Right. And so, I mean, so I think that's a very important component for people trying to figure out what's going on in the United States. And can you kind of talk about the lone wolf attitudes or like how these assassinations in the past could be harbingers of something that could happen in the near or late future?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what the researchers are afraid of is not necessarily like, it's not James Bond. It's not like Al-Qaeda in some cave plotting attacks that then happen in America or plotting assassinations of presidents or something like that. They can handle that. The Secret Service can handle all of that. What is very hard to handle is what they call stochastic terrorism, which is people who essentially self-radicalize. And this can happen incredibly quickly. It can happen seemingly in matters of weeks, which makes predicting it and therefore controlling it really hard, right? And which is the job of the Secret Service, but it becomes very difficult when essentially you've got this like bubbling hatred in America and the hyper-partisanship that is so fueled with rage and which absolutely dominates the country as it stands, and then that kind of explodes. It spikes into violent people. I think they found someone trying to attack Kamala Harris who was exactly that way. It was just recently released. Yeah.
Well, you had that one shooting. You had the left wing shooting on the right wing congressman, right? Was it Scalise or something? I think
that was his name. There's that. Left wing violence is much smaller, but it is real. It's just not quite. It's just not as sizable as right wing violence. I think it's about. I'm not sure I have the number. I think it's about 7% of violence is left wing violence. Not particularly significant.
Right. You do mention CHOP and stuff, but the right wingers are much more.
Yeah, aggro. And you know the left has a way of destroying itself very quickly, right? Like it becomes unsustainable very quick. I mean that's true of both sides, but certainly the left wing stuff seems to peter out much more rapidly.
And what else do you portend like for this kind of individualized radicalization? Like, what do you expect to see?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that worries me is not like, you know, there's been a lot of assassination in American history. Like one of the Secret Service agents I talked to said it's part of the political process here. Right. Like, you know, the one out of 11 American presidents, I think it's slightly smaller than that now, have been assassinated. You know, that's a pretty high number. Like if you took that job and one out of 11 people were killed doing it, you know, that would be, you'd get danger pay for that. Right. So it's not really necessarily the assassination that's worrying. It's, is there room in America now to see a president as a national symbol of unity? Like when JFK was assassinated, he was mourned by everyone. Like truly by everyone, and it was treated as a national catastrophe by everyone. I guess not by Jimmy Hoffa, but by everyone else. You know, that would not happen anymore. I mean, I talked to the sociologist of assassination. And he said that's the key thing. Often assassinations can either unify a country or they can just exacerbate the divisions much more exponentially. And we're clearly at a moment where if that happened, it would just, you know, there would not be mourning right. by one half.
It would be let's man the barricades, I think. And you can see all the threats against Trump. And then he said, like, this division was here before I got here. So, like, the battle lines are being more clarified, I guess, is one way to put it.
Yeah, for sure.
And you talk also kind of, you have this idea of, like, the fall of New York. Can you kind of expand upon, you know, what would happen if to the city of New York in the event, in the future event of this?
Yeah, well... You know, the amazing thing is they have the modeling now is so good that they know when a hurricane hits New York, what streets it'll hit. Right. And so, you know, this really was a case of like the day after, where they just take the scientific data and just kind of make it real, like make it sustainable. Like I managed to interview a reinsurer. You know, that seemed to me like the most reliable person to talk to about possibilities, because, you know, they deal with huge scales of information and they eventually and you know, people make $1 trillion bets on these guys' opinions of it. Right. Like they're quite certain that New York and the whole Eastern Seaboard is quite vulnerable to hurricanes through climate change. And with the rise in sea levels, especially, it's going to be much more vulnerable. And of course, the thing is New York. Like Miami is a great town and New Orleans is a great town. But New York is the center of the world. And if New York were to fall, the consequences of that for everyone would be just absolutely catastrophic. And then the other thing is with New York, because of the density of infrastructure, it's unlike New Orleans or Houston or Miami. You know, if a square kilometer of New York floods, the cost of rebuilding that is virtually impossible to rebuild. Like, because you just won't have the tax base to be able to do it. So then you do have really catastrophic scenarios because it's so vulnerable. And then as I was finishing the book, really. Trump canceled the seawall, which to me is like one of the most, I mean, there's a lot of irresponsibility going on, but to me, that is insane. I mean, that really is like you're in possession of New York City and you're not going to, and you know, it's in danger and you're not going to protect it. That is astonishing to me. Like of all the bad decisions in this book, that's the one that it's like, you're putting New York at risk. You've got to be kidding me, right? Like how many countries in history have ever had a possession like New York City, and you're gonna put it at risk out of like some kind of like, oh, it's not gonna happen. I mean, I'm still flustered by it. Like I still can't quite believe it. Like it just seems to me like an act of pure madness. I mean, it's true that nobody gets elected preventing a catastrophe. You know, that, and that's true everywhere in the world. But, you know, New York, like, how can you leave it exposed? It's just bizarre.
It's very strange, especially just an asset block like that is. And you broke
just
it
as
up.
An asset.
Yeah. And you broke it up between a woman who lives there as two sisters, right? Urban and rural. And I think that urban and rural duality is very important point. Can you?
Yeah. That? I mean, I created these characters, but really they're based on demographic information. I tried to give like, you know, there's no such thing as an average American. Like America's too strange and too diverse. And like, it's too weird. Like there's too many different parts to America for there to be a typical American. But I did the exact financial situation of the average people. I put one of them in rural in Iowa and I put one of them in New York. And then I just saw the economic predictions and environmental predictions about food supply and of course the climate change refugees from New York, which would create, I mean, that's the other thing. Like if New York fell, the number of climate change refugees would be epic, vast.
Just extraordinary, just incredible.
Yeah.
Just millions and millions of people. I mean,
yeah.
it's just like there's a, and you talk about, I think in your intro, you talk about America as complex systems, overlapping systems. If some of those fall, this country's in deep trouble. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, the reason I did it as fiction is because the theory, like the trends behind it are what they call a complex cascading system. So that means that it's like the weather. It's like each thing feeds into itself, right? The seawall is actually a perfect example because like you have this anger. It leads to the election of Trump. The Trump is there because of these bad, because of the Electoral College. This leads to Trump. Trump makes a decision about the wall, about the seawall. The seawall leads to climate change, refugees, which leads to more anger. Like it all feeds into itself. It's not like, you know, there's a lot of books where it's like, here's hyper-partisanship. It's ripping across the country. Here's the environmental catastrophe. It's ripping apart the country. But they're all of a piece. They all feed into each other, right? So that's why I think actually the unimaginable keeps happening. That's why we keep being surprised, right? It's like, you know, if you'd gone back 5 years and said there'll be tanks on the streets of Washington on July 4th, no one would have believed you. Like if you'd gone back 5 years and said, you know, a Republican president will openly support the dictatorship of North Korea, you know, no conspiracy theorist would have imagined that, right? Like it was too crazy. But it keeps happening, right? Like the unimaginable keeps happening. And it's this complex cascading nature of the system, which makes things, you know, turbulent, really.
Right. And I mean, I think that this whole thing with COVID too is exacerbating the problems, definitely increased the haves and have nots. So it's getting higher and higher. Somebody mentioned in the comments, there was somebody who talks about Civil War often. I don't know if you're familiar with Tim Pool. Are you familiar with Tim Pool?
He's a journalist. Sure.
He's a journalist, but he talks about there's a low level Civil War. So it ties right into your book. So I recommend you just typing in Tim Pool Civil War.
I will look that up for sure.
Yeah, and yeah. It really does tie in because he's just showing the culture war is leading to kinetic war. He got swatted last night. Somebody, you know what swatting is, where the SWAT team comes through the door. Like literally the cops were, he was broadcasting, streaming like this, and the cops went in. I mean, it's not funny, but I don't know who did it. Maybe somebody in the chat knows that. But
oh my God.
It is interesting because it really ties into your themes in your books of what he's saying. So I would definitely check that out. Do you mind taking a few questions, Stephen?
No, not at all.
Lee asks, who would you like to see elected in the next presidential election? And what can we do to avert a civil war? Looks like two questions.
I don't really think it matters who gets elected in, like, you know, one thing that I think is really hardest to convince people of is that everything in this book would be true if Hillary Clinton had been elected in 2016. You know, the problems are structural, right? Like the thing to worry about is not who's going to get elected in 2024. The thing to worry about is that in 2040, 30% of the population will control 68% of the Senate. So in those conditions, whatever is elected will be illegitimate. Right. And the structure of power, people will not regard it as legitimate and they won't really believe they're living in a democracy anymore. And from that comes violence. So to me, I'm sort of answering the second question by not answering the first one. Like what needs to happen? And I mean, there's two things that I think really need to happen to avoid a civil war. One is the FBI has to be given enormous resources and devote itself with fury to disrupting and destroying domestic terrorism in the United States. And that is for various reasons that are in the book, that's an extremely complicated undertaking that will be a generational task. It will be like getting the mob out of NYPD. It's going to take a lot to do. And then the other thing is like, I think the time has come for really large scale structural thinking about US government. About whether the Constitution still works, which I don't believe that it does, and whether even options like whether secession is a more viable, provides viable alternatives to a country that's, you know, slipping out of democracy, right? And is increasingly incapable of governing itself. So you know, I would say I don't worry about who's going to win in 2024. I don't particularly think it will make much difference. I think what matters is these structural issues, which really need incredible attention.
Right. And you mentioned, I think, a stat in your book, 88% of young Republicans or Republicans don't believe the last election is fair. That means that, you know, almost half of this country doesn't believe the election was legit. So, yeah. So it's
and then really... what happens in 2028 when Josh Hawley is elected by this with less than 10 million votes, with 10 million votes under the popular vote, which could easily happen. Right. I mean, right. Like Joe Biden and Donald Trump won their elections by the same number of seats in the Electoral College. Joe Biden had won the popular vote by 7 million votes, and Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. You know, that's not, and that number is only growing, right? That number is only, that division is only growing. So, you know, we're very used to thinking of the right not wanting the U.S. government and regarding the government as illegitimate and thinking about secession. But really, the left is going to have to ask itself whether it is invested in this system, which clearly is non-functional. Right. And does not really reflect their doesn't really represent. I mean, 5 out of the current 9 Supreme Court justices were selected by presidents who did not win the popular vote. You know, what is the when they make their ruling on abortion, how many people will really regard it as totally legitimate? I mean, there was a new study. 20% of Americans have faith in their electoral system. 20%. That's a low number. Right. Nothing. And then on the other hand, 33% of Americans think it's OK to use violence against their own government. So, you know, this is not boding well. Right. This requires deep change. This requires deep change.
And really deep thought, just like you said. And I think that even the secessionists on both sides of the aisle, there were I can't remember the stats, but I think it was close that both sides said, yeah, we should secede. Like there was a third of them that said, yeah, secede. So, I mean,
yeah, it's over 50% for Republicans now, and it's 41% of Democrats in California. Wow. Right. So it's growing, and it grows all the time, you know.
Yeah, no, that's really pre-Civil War stuff where you're going to get to the point. And that's kind of like dividing what happened in India. You mentioned India and Pakistan after World War II. That was a secession. They created Pakistan, I guess. But that was it.
Yeah. Disaster. Yeah, I mean, and that was, you know, then they had massive resettlement and massive partition. I mean, and you know, that was compared to the American attempt at secession, civilized conversation, right? I mean, that was done through an agreement. That was done through signed. I mean, India signed over resources to Pakistan, right? They gave them their portion of the national budget. Right. So that's in some ways a more civilized version of any. I mean, it is a more civilized version. And that was, of course, bloody on an epic scale.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, but we're really on kind of a close to the looking over the edge, I think, a lot. And you go into greater detail in your book. You talk about outbreak of violence. You talk about the Republic ending. So you're really discussing really important stuff. But what would you like to add, or is there anything I missed before we wrap up this fascinating discussion?
No, I think we've touched on all the major points. I mean, I just think it's really one of the reasons I wrote this book is because, you know, you see people obsessed over horse race politics, over what's happening today. And it's just I don't really think those are the issues. They really don't reflect what I see as the real crisis facing America. I mean, I would also say that if any country can get out of this, it would be America. America is the country of reinvention. It is the country where they have made radical political ideas work, and they have reimagined the basis of government from the ground up and made it work and become the greatest country in the world on that basis. So, you know, I don't think there's no hope at all, but I do think the hope that needs to go is the hope that things are going to work out, that somehow this the 60s will peter out and we'll all go into the 70s and it'll all be, you know, louche and disco and so on. that's not what's going to happen. Like it's either going to, you know, as I say at the end of the book, like reinvention or fall. Those are the options.
Those are the options, right? Really fascinating, really great book. Where's the best place to get The Next Civil War?
Well, Amazon, speaking Amazon. Of decline and fall.
And this is an audio book too, so that's important. So if people want to listen to the book, they can do that as well. And that's on Amazon. That's true. And if people want to reach out to you or contact you, what's the best means to do so?
I'm on Twitter at Stephen Marsh. And, you know, if you want to email me, I'm StephenMarsh@gmail.com.
I'll put that in the show notes. Stephen Marsh, all one word, right?
M-A-R-C-H-E. R-C-H-E, yeah.
And again, the title of the book is The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, just published January 4th, 2022 by Stephen Marsh. Thanks so much for your time.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Great to be there. All right, stay there. Okay. All right, perfect. All right.